It's as though you are waking up from a very serious operation. You feel pain and you feel fear, and it's like awakening from one nightmare and then you start descending into another.
But Mr. Taylor has caused a lot of death, destruction and damage, not only to people in his own country, but in the entire sub-region.
The people of Liberia are suffering. They need some international assistance now.
They were willing to impeach Nixon for breaking into a building. They will not impeach Bush for breaking into a country. They were willing to impeach Clinton because of his sexual shenanigans, but they will not impeach Bush for his pandering to the super rich.
This is Pacifica's Peace Watch from Monday, August 4th, 2003. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Secretary of State Colin Powell and his top deputy have told the White House they will not serve a second term if President Bush is reelected. That's according to the Washington Post. Officials at the White House and the State Department denied the report in the Post today, saying no such conversation had taken place between Powell and National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice. But the officials refused to speculate about whether Powell would serve in a second Bush term. Powell and Deputy Secretary of State Richard Armitage plan to talk with Bush in Texas tomorrow and Wednesday for a long-planned series of meetings, White House spokesman Scott McClellan said. He denied that Powell and Armitage ever told Rice they would not serve after 2005, saying no such conversation had taken place. The Post reported today that both men plan to step down in January 2005, even if Bush is reelected. U.S. military casualties from the occupation of Iraq have been more than twice the number most Americans have been led to believe because of an extraordinarily high number of accidents, suicides, and other non-combat deaths in the ranks that have gone largely unreported in the media. Since May 1st, when President George Bush declared the end of major combat operations, 52 American soldiers have been killed by hostile fire, according to the Pentagon and its figures, quoted in almost all the war coverage. But the total number of U.S. deaths from all causes is much higher, 112. The other unreported cost of the war for the U.S. is the number of American wounded, 827 since Operation Iraqi Freedom began. In fact, the total death toll is 248, including accidents and suicides. And as the number of non-combat deaths and serious injuries become more widely known, the erosion of public confidence is likely to continue, posing a threat to President Bush's prospects of re-election, which at the beginning of May had seemed a foregone conclusion. Several hundred Nigerian peacekeeping forces arrived in Monrovia, Liberia today as the first of a series of West African deployments intended to quell the 14-year civil war in that country and remove embattled President Charles Taylor from office. The forces were greeted by anxious civilians and cheering rebel factions who look forward to the end of warfare and the resumption of humanitarian aid. It's expected that as many as 5,000 troops from ECOWAS, the Economic Community of West African States, will be deployed to Liberia by the end of the month. For some insight into the situation, Peace Watch spoke earlier today with Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, former Liberian presidential candidate and a participant in the Liberian peace talks currently taking place in Accra, Ghana. We began by asking for her reaction to today's peacekeeping deployments.
Overall, we're just glad it's happening and hope that more troops will get in there to secure the safety of our people so they can be able to get out of their homes and out of the public buildings they've been hiding in for the past several weeks.
What are the conditions like there in Liberia for the average citizen?
Oh, hardship. Extreme hardship. I mean, you might say suffering. You have people that have been caught between factions, indiscriminate shooting, missiles passing all over, some of it landing in population centers. No economic activity functioning. Everything's closed down, even the general markets where people buy their normal staples. And, you know, you've got lots of kids. You see the photos in the newspapers, on television, where, you know, the scene is being covered, and we have to weep because this is not something that Liberia is accustomed to. We've never known starvation. We've known poverty, of course, but not starvation, not total collapse of everything around us, and people with absolutely no food for themselves, for their children, no medical supplies, no clean water. You know, they have to catch the rainwater that comes down off the rooftops. It's profound, and that characterizes, I would say, even in our rural areas. We don't know what's happening there because nobody can get there. I do believe they have to run from their villages because of the fighting in those areas. They're probably hiding in bushes and in forests, scavenging for whatever they can get to be able to survive. It's a calamity for our country and our people.
Are there any semblances of a routine, going to work, going to school, any worship opportunities, or any semblance of ordinary life?
Oh, absolutely not. That has stopped. Okay. In the major population centers.
Over the past several months, Liberians have continually demanded that the U.S. deploy its own forces as well. Isn't today's entrance of the West African forces adequate enough? And what concerns do you have, if any, about them?
Let me say that the regional forces, the forces of the West African Economic Community, are very welcomed. However, they have indicated quite clearly they don't have the full capacity and the capability to be able to intervene effectively and timely, and they have asked for supplemental intervention, particularly by the United States. We believe that because people respect and admire the U.S., Liberia being so close to it with a strong historical relationship, people have welcomed U.S. troops, U.S. boots on the ground, because it gives that little extra confidence. There are some concerns about, some of our West African states, because the conflict in Liberia is sort of a regional conflict, and we have many states in the region that have some involvement in the conflict, and that does raise mm-hmm. some genuine concern about neutrality and objectivity. But that said, let me say, mm-hmm. they've come to our aid. Mm-hmm. They've done what they can. They are very welcome. We're very pleased. And at least they've been the first ones to be there. And so they're our brothers. And all we have to do is to hope that they get the kind of support from the U.S. that will enable them to carry out their duties.
Mm-hmm. What about the role of Nigeria? We've talked to some analysts, and many of them are from the Liberian community here in the States, who are quite concerned of the role that Nigerian troops will play in this particular intervention, given the history of Nigerian troops participating in this war.
Nigeria was the first country to agree to intervene in the interest of peace and bringing this conflict to an end. Yes, the experience of Nigerian and other regional soldiers in the previous war of 1990 was mixed, but they did save lives. And had they not intervened then and now, more people would have died. So I have to say that with all the concerns, we have to say thank you to Nigeria for being the first one on the block to say, we're ready to go in. We're ready to go and do something for them. And Nigeria does have the might.
Nigeria has also offered asylum, if you will, to President Charles Taylor. What do you suppose will happen to President Taylor?
I think Mr. Taylor has to face the court. I mean, Mr. Taylor has been indicted by a UN special court. It's for crimes committed in another country, forgetting even the crimes committed, you know, in our own country.
Some have said that his leaving Liberia and going to Nigeria may provide him cover from having to face these charges from the international court for, I believe he's charged with war crimes.
That's correct. Mm-hmm. I mean, the indictment is very clear, and the indictment is based on a stack of evidence. What Nigeria offers him, what Nigeria is prepared to do to protect him or not protect him, again, is something that Nigeria will have to, you know, to answer to, being a bona fide member of the international community that subscribes to the International Code of Conduct.
Mm-hmm.
But Mr. Taylor has caused a lot of death, destruction, and damage, not only to people in his own country, but in the entire sub-region. And, you know, and it's time that the day of reckoning has come.
Can you talk a little bit about your own political background in Liberia and your past relationship with President Charles Taylor?
First of all, I was in the Liberian government of President Talbot when Mr. Taylor was part of a student organization in the United States, invited, you know, back home because they had been mounting pressure on the Talbot government for much-needed reform. And so I met him for the first time when he went with this group, returned to Liberia. And then it wasn't long after that, there was the coup d'etat. I then was a finance minister and was deposed in a coup d'etat and did not, since I did was not part of the government that followed. The government that followed the 1980 coup d'etat was Samuel Doe's government. And even though I headed the Liberian Bank for a few months after what most of us, I returned to the U.S. and to the service of the World Bank. And then I wasn't there in the country anymore during the time that Mr. Taylor was part of that government. And I just followed the news like everybody else and never saw him again until we were over here with an organization trying to put political pressure on the military dictatorship. And subsequently, Mr. Taylor started his movement, and some of us embraced it as a natural means of bringing added pressure on the military dictatorship to effect the changes that we thought were needed. I never saw him again. We did give some small support to his movement, several of us over here, but then it wasn't very long into that his true colors came out because we, you know, many of our very trusted colleagues who were in the country and who went for safety behind his lines were brutally murdered. And so we, from then distance, and then his own, the revelation of his aim to take power, his greed, his everything came to light. And so, as we had before, we begin to mount pressure again for change.
It's reported that you were one of only four government ministers who escaped assassination while 13 others were shot and killed. Can you recount that experience for us?
Oh, that was the 1980 coup d'etat when a group of enlisted soldiers deposed the government. And for whatever reason, they did put on the beach at stakes and shot 13 high-level officials, ministers. But it was a terrible day for our country. In fact, I may think that that still lingers today. We haven't come to grips with that. We haven't faced up to the brutality and the implications and the consequences of those, of the action on that day, because we robbed our country of its then leaders, and we've never really repented for that. It was a terrible day for Liberia, and it introduced into our society the kinds of violence that has just permeated the society and grown in dimension over the years. Until today, we have, you know, young people who've never been to school, who only know violence as a way of life and a way of survival. And those are the challenges that we're going to face in a new Liberia.
More recently, you've just returned from taking part in the Liberian peacekeeping talks in Ghana. I understand you presented a briefing on your trip here in Washington. Can you sort of recap the presentation that you made regarding Ghana?
I just went over with a group of colleagues and friends, you know, where we are in Accra, you know, who the participants are. There are the two warring factions, the government, the 18 political parties, civil society organizations, observers, and the process is being led by ECOWAS, supported by the African Union, the United Nations, United States, the European Union. There's a mediator, the former president of Nigeria, General Abu Salami Abubakar. And the process is, you know, first of all, to agree on the security arrangements, and that's been largely agreed, an intervention force called for, which is now in the process of being implemented. That's going to secure the environment, bring confidence. That force is also going to be involved in disarmament, demobilization, reintegration of not only combatants, but the large numbers of our population that displaced. And then the formulation of a transitional government that's going to be, we hope, all-inclusive of all the parties participating. We think that now things are accelerating, and we're all hopeful that at least maximum 2 weeks we should bring the Accra talks to a successful conclusion.
What do you see as a more realistic, appropriate response to Mr. Taylor's administration at this time?
Oh, we want a transitional government that's going to have people that have the requisite commitment, you know, to delivering service to the people, commitment to democracy, commitment to addressing the human rights violations with which has been faced, getting our people repatriated, getting arms out of all the hands of our young people that have been drugged, these child soldiers. And then, of course, preparing the grounds for free and fair elections so the Liberian people can have a true choice of their leader.
What are your political aspirations, and do you plan on running again?
Yes, I do. In fact, I hope that I'll be a part of the transitional government that will come out of the Accra process. I hope that I will be on the team that starts to restore Liberia. We're not going to have perfection, and it's not going to be a quick fix for our country, given the kinds of decline that we have faced for more than two decades. But I think it's time that we start the process, and I want to be a part of that.
Ellen Johnson Sirleaf is a former Liberian presidential candidate and a participant in the Liberian peace talks currently taking place in Accra, Ghana. She stopped by Peace Watch's studios earlier today. About half of Liberia's 3 million residents are trapped by fighting while they wait in hope for international intervention. And with much of the country's access to the outside world cut off, international aid organizations say a humanitarian crisis is looming on the not-so-distant horizon. Janet Fleischman, Washington Director for Africa of the group Human Rights Watch, spoke recently with Peace Watch Associate Producer Angelique Shofar about her group's analysis of the situation in Liberia and their recommendations for U.S. policy.
Well, we've been calling for the peacekeeping forces to be deployed immediately to Liberia and not to wait for him to leave and not to wait for the ceasefire to be fully implemented, because the people of Liberia are suffering, and they need some international assistance now to begin to address the situation that they've been subjected to for so many years, and certainly in recent weeks. So we also see that the indictment against Charles Taylor, which came down from the Special Court of Sierra Leone, has to be respected, and Charles Taylor should be held accountable for his involvement in the Sierra Leone conflict. But let's not forget that that doesn't deal with what he and other factions were responsible for in Liberia, and that needs to be a piece of what Liberians are able to confront in terms of accountability for abuses in their own country.
What is your take on the warlords being indicted and not just Charles Taylor?
There should be accountability for all sides in Liberia. Charles Taylor's forces have been responsible for terrible abuses for many years, for almost 14 years in Liberia, but they are not the only abusers in this conflict. And for it to have legitimacy, it needs to look at all sides.
Now, Janet, it is reported that America used Liberia in many of its operations against Libya in the 80s, and Libya responded by supporting Charles Taylor's civil war in 1989. Now, there is a general impression held by Liberians that America is directly responsible for Liberia's miseries. Do you think it's fair that ECOWAS should continuously shoulder the responsibility of restoring peace and stability in Liberia while the United States, so to speak, sit on a fence?
No, and that is why we've been calling for the U.S. to play a role in a broader multinational effort. It shouldn't just be the sub-regional actors, not only because, as you say, they shouldn't only bear the burden, but also because many of them are implicated in some of the problems. So it should be a broader effort.
How can Liberian groups and other concerned organizations help in this mission in conjunction with Human Rights Watch?
I think they are playing and will continue to play one of the most critical roles, because one of the things that we stress when asked about the situation in Liberia, is how even during the darkest days of the regime of Samuel Doe and under President Charles Taylor, Liberian civil society actors have been amazingly committed and courageous in terms of human rights lawyers, independent journalists, women's rights activists, religious groups. That is the hope for Liberia. And those actors will be needed in all their diversity to help bring on a new time for Liberia. And that my hope would be that they are able to work together to pool their talents and resources to be able to really show the world that if you can isolate the people with the guns, then the other Liberians can take control of their country.
Any final thoughts or even a message that you'd like to share?
I think it's a very important moment for people in this country to realize, first of all, the extent of the humanitarian disaster in Liberia and the amount that this country can do working with other countries in the subregion and internationally to help stop this terrible bloodshed in Liberia. And the U.S. really has an important role to play. And this is the time for the U.S. to step up to the plate and assist Liberians in taking control of their own country again.
Janet Fleischman is Human Rights Watch's Washington Director for Africa. She spoke recently with Peace Watch Associate Producer Angelique Shofar. Meanwhile, back in the Arab world, as we continue to hear about the lack of security and order in Iraq, among the more horrifying stories coming out of Baghdad these days is the unprecedented kidnapping of people and especially young women by organized gangs. Many families say they're worried about the fate of their daughters and sons, and they keep constant watch over them lest kidnappers approach their loved ones. Ahmed Arawi, Peace Watch's correspondent in Baghdad, has this report.
20-year-old Arij is like most students at Al Tahaddi School in Al Mansour district in Baghdad. She spends her time watching satellite channels since satellite receivers were banned by Saddam Hussein. She also tries to read when there is a continuous lack of electricity in a country that enjoys unprecedented temperature degrees. But for Arij and her classmates, focusing on schoolwork and gaining an education are increasingly difficult, given the current dangers of life in Iraq. Arij recalls a recent incident when her mother came to pick her up at school.
We finished a lecture at about 12 o'clock noon time. We walked to the main street to catch a cab when suddenly an Oldsmobile passed by with four men inside. They parked the car near us, and an armed man approached us. He pointed his gun at my mother and told her to let me go. He pulled me, and my mother shouted loud. I don't know what happened to me, as if my legs were paralyzed while I was shaking. My mother pulled me from one side, and he pulled from another. He told my mother, "Let her go, release her." He fired once from his gun, followed by a second, and then a third time. Because of the sound of the shooting, the staff of the Dar al Salaam hospital went outside to see what was happening. Seeing all the attention they had drawn, the other men inside the car called the armed man, and they drove away.
Arij says her family did not bother to report the incident to any official policing bodies or to the American military police.
What shall we report? To whom shall we report? There is no use in reporting. There is no government. To whom shall we report? And to whom shall we complain?
Arij's mother, who follows her daughter like her shadow, now carries a gun in her suitcase for the sole reason of protecting her daughter. She says,
"Even if there is a checkpoint where the Americans find this gun with me, I will tell them that I am protecting myself because there is no one to guard me. I will show them the gun myself. Why should they consider that I am hiding a weapon? At which time did we reach this level of debasement?"
Basil Behnam, the owner of Atlas Publishing House, was also abducted recently. His family paid $40,000 in ransom for his safe return. Since being released, Basil has been interviewed once, but he refused later to be interviewed because he was threatened by the suggestion that his young child would be kidnapped. He and his family are now living outside of Iraq since he finds life in the country unsafe. Another case is that of Ahmed Abdel Jabbar, a 14-year-old boy who has been rescued recently. Abdel Jabbar Salim is the principal of Al Ja'afar School, which the boy attended.
"Some residents near the apartments of Haifa Street came to the school and informed us that one of our students in the second year of the intermediate level had been kidnapped on his way to school. This student is clever and keen in his readings and studies. We informed the student's parents about this matter, and they took the required measures by informing the concerned authorities. We ask God to prevent such tragedies from happening, which never occurred in the past."
Ahmed Abdel Jabbar left Baghdad with his family and is now living in the north. He did not pursue his studies in his school, fearing that he will be abducted again. Human Rights Watch has issued a statement expressing concern over the dangers of this new wave of kidnappings. The group's Baghdad spokesperson is Hani Mejali.
"Our findings are that this is part of a crime wave in Baghdad. Certainly it seems to be something new for women to be abducted in broad daylight. In some instances, they've been taken away, they've been raped, they've been held hostage. In some cases they were released a few days later. In other cases the families are still looking for them. Clearly this is part of the problem of security in Baghdad. We tried to look into incidents of rape before the war, and although we weren't able to do a scientific study, certainly the impression is that the numbers are higher. In the police stations, they were talking about maybe getting a few cases each month, and we were hearing about 6, 7, 8 cases in 1 or 2 weeks.
Human Rights Watch has reminded the American administration of its obligation to address this situation. It says that the U.S. occupying power has this responsibility to preserve law and order according to the 4th Geneva Convention. Again, Hani Mejali.
the whole international community has been reminding the coalition forces here, the United States in particular, that there is an obligation to safeguard the civilian population and protect the civilian population. And clearly, whereas the war might have been won, the peace has yet to be won. And the problem has been that the manpower was not here, the translators were not here, the planning was really for the war, but once the war was over, they didn't seem to have had a plan for how to conduct themselves post-war.
The press office of the American administration in Iraq refused to comment on this sensitive topic. Many Iraqis say that despite public services still desperately lacking, establishing safety and security remain the most pressing needs in Iraqi society today. For Pacifica's Peace Watch, this is Ahmed Arawi in Baghdad.
You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. We'll be back in a moment.